Welcome back to our wonderful course called My God, and we are gathered tonight for lesson number 4, a very exciting one. And I know I say that before every one of the classes because it's true every single time, but of course, especially the one that we're actually holding up to. So thank you for joining us, and like we said, I hope everyone had a very nice and relaxing Thanksgiving. So, about 2 hours ago, a new nephew was born to us. Esty's brother in South Lake, Texas, had their number 8 baby boy. So, and that's only about 3 weeks after the previous nephew was born to us. I'm just giving you the last 3 hours of news. If you want to talk about 2 days, there may be... they're the only family we have here in Texas. They're in South Lake, right outside of Dallas. They lead the Chabad of South Lake. So we wish them congratulations.
It's your brother-in-law with the red beard?
Yeah. We used to see each other more often before we both got busier in our communities and families, and it's hard to schlep and put them all into one vehicle. But anyway, so that's a little bit of good news. All right, so we are gathered tonight for lesson 4 called His Expectations. So if you will, in the first 3 lessons we discussed, first, we can say we discussed God's resume. We talked about what God is, what God isn't, before we even said what He is, or before we started to discuss anything about God. We spoke about His nature, His makeup. And now, already last week, we started talking about God's relationship with the world. Last week, we talked about if God needs us or if He just wants us, and why did God create evil in the world, etc. Tonight, we have 4 exciting questions. Hopefully, we'll get through all 4 of them. I believe we will. Number 1, do I have to believe in God to be Jewish? I get this question a lot. Not necessarily, you know how it is. Everyone asks for a friend. If somebody doesn't believe in God, are they still Jewish? Number 2, is it kosher to have doubts about God? If someone has doubts, is it okay? Or does that put a question mark on someone's whole Jewish status or identity? Number 3, we'll talk tonight about why must I fear God? We talk a lot about loving God, but there's also a lot of reference to fearing God. And sometimes people cringe when they come across that term. Why do we have to fear God? Well, it doesn't seem to be a healthy emotion. We'll talk about that. And finally, number 4, we'll talk about if someone is okay with believing in God, but they're not religious, could they still be in a relationship with God if they are not religious? No, was I right that these aren't exciting topics tonight? All right, so let's get to work with question number 1 for tonight. Do I have to believe in God to be Jewish? All right, so religion, when you think of religion, it's usually a set of beliefs, and it's usually a group of people subscribe to it, to that particular set of beliefs. And in Judaism, of course, we know that believing in God is pretty important. It's high up there, belief in God. I mean, it's the first 2 of the 10 commandments. The first one is, I am the Lord your God. The second one, not to believe or not to embrace any other, or not to worship any other God other than me. So it's right up there. The question, though, is, must a Jew believe in God to be a Jew? We know it's important in Judaism, very important in Judaism, but is it a defining factor of somebody's Jewish identity or status, if they believe in God or not? So the reality is, by the raise of hand, how many of you know a Jew who will say about themselves that they don't believe in God? Majority of hands went up. So we all know such Jews. The question is, what does that mean? Does it question their status? Does it not? And for that matter, will even discover if there is even such a thing as a Jew who doesn't believe in God. All right, so please join me on page 112 in your book. On page 112, exercise 4.1. By the way, there's pens and pads of paper in the middle of both rows of tables. If you like, you can ask someone to pass. Exercise 4.1, what is a Jew? So we look at the terms below, along with their definitions, and let's see what is the makeup of a Jew. What we're going to explore now is what is a Jew. Once we establish what is a Jew, then we can figure out if a Jew needs to believe in God in order to be a Jew, or maybe not. So let's see what a Jew is, for starters. The question is, are the Jewish people a race? And we have the definitions here of a race, culture, nation, or religion. Shelley, how about reading the four things for us, if you're okay with it? And we'll, by each one, we'll try to figure out if the Jewish people are, or if Judaism, are any of these four.
Race, a group that humans are often divided into based on physical traits regarded as common among people of shared ancestry.
Okay, pause. So is Judaism a race?
No,
let's go on.
Culture, the customary beliefs, social norms, and material traits of a racial, religious, or social group.
Is it a culture?
No.
Abyssal?
I would say yes, sort of.
Okay, sort of. Let's go on.
Nation, a people having a common origin, tradition, and language, and capable of forming or actually constituting a nation state.
Okay, how about that one?
No.
Yes.
I heard no's and I heard yeses. You must have a fine group of Jews here in the room. How about the fourth one? Is it a religion?
Religion, a cause, principle, or system of beliefs held to with ardor and faith.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Any no's?
All of the above.
All of the above. Okay. Anyone say none of the above? No, nope. I didn't hear that. So let's take a look. Could it be a race? Is Judaism a race? The problem is there are Jews of all races. So it can't just be that. Could it be a culture? Well, I may like certain foods. You may like some other foods. Right? Raise your hand if you're a bagels and lox Jew. Raise your hand if you're a cholent, kishka, or schmaltz herring Jew. All different types, right? I know, it's only the ones that I know. What do Sephardic Jews like? We have to get Modi in here to do a...
Shakshuka.
Shakshuka, anyone for shakshuka?
Oh, yeah.
See?
Yeah.
So it can't quite be a culture. How about a nation? There are Jews living as loyal citizens in every nation. Not only that, we didn't even always have a nation state for almost 2,000 years, yet we were still the Jewish people, so it can't only be that. How about a religion? There are millions of Jews who identify as Jewish, yet not religious. So, let's take a look at the...
What makes a Jewish person Jewish? Do you need a kippah, a necklace, synagogue membership? Do you have to do anything at all? Here's a mythbuster. Plenty of Jewish people have never seen a synagogue and have no clue about Jewish symbols, beliefs, traditions, or cuisine. But they are as Jewish as Moses. So, what's it all about? You see, we love to sort things into categories, create neat labels, and use those labels to help us understand our world a little better. Here are four popular ways of classifying people. Does being Jewish have to do with any of these? Are you Jewish because you belong to the Jewish race? Hold on, is there even such a thing as a Jewish race? Look at these images. These folks are all equally Jewish. Race doesn't appear to be a factor. Actually, non-Jewish people from the most diverse places and races can become fully Jewish. So we clearly can't define Jewishness as belonging to a specific race. Why don't we try culture? Are you Jewish because you follow the Jewish culture? Well, you might be, if there was a Jewish culture to follow. But there is no single culture common to all Jews. Here's why. The ancient Jews lived in the land of Israel for over a millennia, but they were forced into exile by the ancient Romans. That happened almost 2 millennia ago. Since then, Jews settled all over the globe. The result of Jews spending centuries in very different kinds of places was that they developed many very distinct cultures, including unique ways of dressing, unique foods, styles of music, prayers, practices, dialect, and celebrations. The result? There is no single uniform Jewish culture. So Jewishness is not based on culture. What about nationality? That's a legal term. It means that you belong to a certain country or state. If Jewish is a description of your nationality, it would mean that you are a citizen of a Jewish state. But that's not the case. We've got British, French, Italian, Turkish, South African, Swedish, Spanish, Argentinian, and Indian Jews. You'll find Jews in every country, and almost all of them are citizens only of the state within which they reside. Even the state of Israel includes millions of non-Jewish Israeli citizens. That pops the nationality argument, doesn't it? And here's a bigger buster. Historically, the Jews did not have an independent state for most of their existence as a people. Strike three. Religion. That sounds good. Are you Jewish because you follow the Jewish religion? Well, no, because many Jews do not associate themselves with any religion. In fact, there are many Jews who do not even know they are Jewish. And there are also Jews who practice a religion other than Judaism. But according to Judaism, they are all equally Jewish. Phew, this is really tough. I guess it's time for the one and only Jewish answer. Being Jewish means that you have a Jewish soul. How do you get a Jewish soul? The most common way is through a Jewish mother. You see, according to Judaism, every child to a Jewish mother is naturally born with a Jewish soul. Your mother's race and nationality make no difference. She might follow the Jewish religion or culture, or she might not. But if she's Jewish, you're Jewish. And there's no opting out. If you're born a Jew, it means that God decided that you're meant to be Jewish for life. So if you're Jewish, thank your mom. Then there's conversion. If you were not born to a Jewish mother, but you complete the authentic and challenging Jewish process of becoming Jewish, God will give you a Jewish soul at the moment of conversion. So what can we take away from all this? It is the privilege and responsibility of each Jew to lead a Jewish life. But those who do not are authentically Jewish. Living the Jewish way allows your soul to shine, but it does not create your soul. That's already alive and kicking inside you, waiting for you to connect. So what is a Jew? It's a spiritual force within you.
There you have it. So, what is Judaism? What is that singular item that captures the essence of what a Jew is? Now we know it is the Jewish soul. That's what Judaism says. If we ask Judaism this question, Judaism would answer that it is the Jewish soul. And that's the neshama, as just stated. It either comes to us through being born to a Jewish mother or by converting to Judaism according to Jewish law. And either of those two are 100% Jewish and equally Jewish. And once you have the soul, then you are Jewish and nobody or nothing can take it away.
Where are those Jewish law coming from God?
That's a loaded question. So Jewish law starts from the Torah, from the five books of Moses, and then from the full 24 books of the broader, what we'll call the Bible.
And I'm talking about the converts.
So it originates in the Torah, but then besides for the written tradition, there's also the oral tradition. We may have touched on this in maybe the first session a little bit. And it's much to cover it now and do justice to it, but just very briefly, that the oral tradition was communicated by God to Moses while he remained on the mountain, Mount Sinai, for 40 days and 40 nights. And he taught it to his student, Joshua, and so on and so forth, until eventually it was written down in what's known as the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the first recorded law of the oral tradition. And then it was analyzed further in the Talmud, eventually by Maimonides, and eventually in the Code of Jewish Law, which we refer to and study until today. But that's in very brief. Yes, Debbie?
Very brief. If you're born with your soul and you're not a Jewish person, and then you convert, does your soul transform?
You acquire a Jewish soul. By going through the process, by taking upon yourself to live like a Jew, which is...
So your soul kind of transforms. It's not like your other soul is going to...
Well, it's a spiritual process. But when you do make that commitment and you immerse in the mikvah in front of a court of three qualifying rabbis, at that moment, the person acquires a Jewish soul. Again, I don't want to get too much into it, but... There is a fascinating idea which says that when somebody does convert properly, it actually reveals that they had this soul in a concealed way from birth. But God's plan was that this individual should only become in touch with their soul at a given point in their life when they actually convert. In other words, it was part of the plan that that individual will convert. But instead of being born a Jew, they would embrace it and choose it on their own. Make sense? Okay.
One quick question. So
sure.
Time period of the Mishnah, real quick.
The Mishnah was authored by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, give or take roughly 2,000 years. I may be off by 100 years, but you'll forgive me. So about 2,000 years ago.
So 1,000 years after Moses.
Yeah, roughly. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Was there a certain amount of generations that had to pass before the soul was going to be revealed?
You mean within that individual?
With that individual.
I don't know. I mean, there were converts throughout all our history. Are you saying from...
I feel like I learned in another class that when a Jewish soul is hidden,
it could be. I don't claim to know it all, but my only question is, it doesn't seem to always be the same amount with every individual. There were converts as of a couple thousand years ago. Some of the greatest sages were converts or came from converts. So, let's read text number 2, being that I started in the middle. Linda, want to pick up? Please, text number 2 on page 114.
Jewishness is not a casual feature of Jew's identity. Rather, it is his or her very essence. The status of a human, animal, or vegetable is immutable. Declaring that one is no longer human, that an animal really isn't an animal, or that a vegetable is no longer a vegetable, is ineffective. Even if a person would go so far as to deny their own existence or the existence of the human species, it still won't help. This is not a question of free will. We possess free will over our behavior, action, speech, and thought, but not over our essence and identity.
Thank you very much. So, we're not going to say, of course, that a Jew doesn't need to believe in God. That would be a mistake to suggest that, a big mistake. But the lack of Jewish practice, or even the lack of belief in God, doesn't make a Jew not Jewish. It is their essence, it's their soul, and you can't take it away, regardless of what type of lifestyle they live. Just like someone who is an American citizen and happens to break a law, is still an American citizen, even after that. Yes, maybe they need to take care of the law that they broke, and they're accountable, but they don't lose their citizenship just by breaking a law. Yes?
If somebody converts to Christianity, are they still a Jewish soul?
You cannot lose your Jewish identity even if you convert out of Judaism, because you didn't really do so. You're just making believe. It's something it's something additional onto you. It's not a real change.
So if you're born from a Jew, But if you're a convert and want to go back,
you're stuck.
Stuck.
Basically, yeah. So let me share something fascinating with you. Okay? So around the high holidays, as we know, the synagogues become very, very full. Imagine you do this. Let's say you walk into any church on a Sunday, walk over to any average person and say to them, do you believe in God? They're going to look at you like you're crazy, right? Of course they believe in God. We're in a church here. Do you ask them if they're religious? Of course I'm religious. Do the same thing to a Muslim on a Friday. Go into a mosque, the same questions, and you're going to get a yes to if you believe in God. You're going to get a resounding yes if you ask them if they're religious. Now walk into any synagogue at Kol Nidre and walk over to your average Jew sitting in the pews and ask them these questions. Sir, do you believe in God? What do you think the answer you're going to get? What kind of question is that? What does belief mean? What is God? I don't know. It depends. Maybe it's different phases in my life. I used to. Maybe in the future. Then follow up with the question, are you religious? Me? I'm the furthest thing from religious. So tell me, what are you doing here in synagogue? What do you mean? It's Yom Kippur. Where else should I be? Could you explain that conversation to me? Does it make any sense to you?
Yes.
It does? You're right. It does. Even though you're hearing two extremes within 60 seconds from this person. What's going on here? So on one hand, this Jewish person, as we said, you can have someone who claims they don't believe in God and they're still Jewish, and they are. At the same time, the follow-up question, this person is saying, well, it's Yom Kippur, and there's nowhere else that I could be other than the synagogue. That sounds like a pretty religious Jew, right? I mean, if you weren't religious, then who cares where you are in Yom Kippur? If you care enough to be in synagogue, that means you're religious. So how does this all work out? And this is, it all makes sense, because what's happening is that when they say that they can't be anywhere else on Yom Kippur but in synagogue, that is the essence of their soul speaking. And on Yom Kippur, or Rosh Hashanah, whatever, one individual's day is, the essence of their soul emerges and is revealed, and it's their soul speaking. And it's correct that they can't be anywhere else but in synagogue, because their soul believes in God regardless of what they think on the surface consciously. They may consciously not believe in God, but deep down, even when they think they don't, they still do. A Jew always believes in God, regardless of what's going on the surface. So, as we're taught in the Talmud in text number 3, that even one who sins remains a Jew. You can't lose that identity. And a Jew can't renounce his Jewishness. So what is a Jew? One who has a Jewish soul. Number one, a Jewish soul is attained by birth or through conversion. Practice or beliefs do not impact one's Jewish status. Even one who sins remains a Jew. You can't discard your essence. It's always there. You can't undo it. And it always remains intact. Elie Wiesel, who we talked about or heard a video from last week, he tells a story of something that he witnessed in Auschwitz. He actually saw a Nazi approach a Jew. And he said to the Jew, he told him to bow down to the cross. And this Jew refused. And the Nazi beat this Jew as a result. And then after the beating, told him again to bow down to the cross. And he absolutely refused. And unfortunately, his life was taken right then and there. So Wiesel says that the son of this person saw what happened, and he couldn't believe it. He said, my father never believed in God one day of his life. And here he was, not just willing, but actually lost his life because he wouldn't renounce his Jewish faith when it came to that critical moment. How do you explain that? Because yes, all his life, he didn't consciously believe in God, but his essence was intact, and it can't not be intact. Nothing could impact the essence of the Jew. Just like we said, a human can't become unhuman, and the same about an animal, the same about a vegetable. You can't change your essence. You have a choice in how you want to behave, that yes. Your essence, you can't undo. And the essence remains 100% exactly what it was. There was a story in the 1940s when the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, my namesake, came to this country, came in 1940 to New York. And there was actually a time when he was considering setting up shop, so to speak, not in Brooklyn, but in Chicago. There were a few locations considered. And he had some contacts there of people who either they or their parents or grandparents were connected to the Chabad movement or the Hasidic movement in the old country. But anyway, he established himself in New York, and he asked one of his or two of his followers, Rabbi Shmuel Levitin, to take a trip to Chicago to visit a few people there. And he did that. It was a wealthy individual that lived there, and he went to meet him. And the reason why he wanted him to meet him is because he was a grandson of a member of the Chabad community back in Europe. Bottom line is, they sit down, and he says, okay, who do I write the check out to? And Rabbi Levitin says, that's not what we came for. Because that's what he was used to. A rabbi comes, that's what you do. But he said, why are you here? He said, well, the Rebbe sent me to speak to you about Judaism and to encourage you to embrace your Jewishness, your Jewish identity, even here in this country. And very nice. He was very touched by the meeting and very moved by the agenda and purpose of the meeting. The rabbi comes back to New York, and he shares with the Rebbe who sent him to Chicago. He tells him what happened. And he told him that he told this Jew, his name was Mr. Listener, he said, I explained him that every Jew is essential to the Jewish people. Just like you have a Torah. When you have a Torah, there's 304,000 letters in the Torah. That's and plus change. If one letter is missing from a Torah that's written by hand, every single letter is written by hand. If one letter is missing, are you allowed to use that Torah for a public reading? No, it's disqualified if one letter is missing. So the rabbi said that when speaking to Mr. Listener, I spoke about this idea, how every letter is essential to the entire Torah being valid. Similarly, every individual Jew is essential to the entire Jewish people. But the Rebbe said, actually, if I was meeting with him, I would have went further and said the following, that it's not only, the connection of a Jew to Judaism is not only like a letter written in the Torah. Why is that? Because ultimately it's ink written on parchment. Could you disconnect the two? You could, just like you write, you can also erase a letter. What you should have told him is that a Jew in Judaism is like letters that were written in stone of the two tablets. When you write something in stone, it's inseparable. When you put ink on parchment, you could separate the two. And a Jew and Judaism are inseparable, like a letter written in stone. You can do whatever you want. You can cover it up. You can fill it up. It can collect dust. But the letter is still there. It's intact. And that is what defines the connection between a Jew and Judaism. And it's indestructible, and nothing can change it. So just to kind of sum up this this topic. So one last idea here. Sometimes I'm driving on Sundays on Bel Air Boulevard, especially if I go towards the medical center, and there are some very prominent houses of worship, non-Jewish ones on Bel Air Boulevard. And there's a lot of traffic. There's long lines of cars coming out, circling blocks. And I'm like, I have to wait till Yom Kippur for this to happen at the shul. Here it's happening every Sunday. What's going on? What is it with us? Why can't we get our act together? So obviously there's a lot of components here, but just one thought. And that is that in other religions, often God is viewed as a very powerful entity. Let's just say somebody has a friend, a good friend, and your friend runs for the Senate and becomes a U.S. Senator. So now you have this friend, a friend in high places, and everyone loves to have that. And what if the senator friend of yours tells you, you know what, I want you to come to my office every Sunday for lunch. You're gonna show up, obviously, if you live in within proximity. You're gonna show up every week because you want to maintain this friendship. It's an important friendship. It's a powerful person. You never know. You never know who you'll need and when. And you're gonna be there all the time. However, in Judaism, the way we view God is not necessarily like this powerful individual, but rather like our own mother. Now, I'm sure within this room, no two people have the same patterns in how often they visit their mother. Some people it's every day, some people once a week, sometimes it's once a year on Thanksgiving, sometimes you only call her on Mother's Day. And in some cases, you know, you may have not spoken to her in years. And in Judaism, it's the same thing. If God is not this powerful entity in our life who we have to show up to in order to keep the relationship going, it's a relationship like a parent. And with a parent, everyone has different patterns. You don't have to show up every single week. Still your mother if you don't show up. A few months can go by. You get upset. Better relationship, worse relationship. One day you love her, one day you like her, one day you don't like her, you just love her, another day neither, and that's how it is. By the way, totally off topic, but people wonder very often why Jews in synagogue, especially the more Orthodox synagogues, and we'll talk about labels later on tonight, Jews don't necessarily behave so reverent in their synagogues. People talk, people chat. Sometimes even during services. And I'm not condoning that whatsoever. But sometimes the more Orthodox the synagogue, the more talking is going on during the service. And why is that? Even within Judaism, I would say, the more, I'll just use the term reform synagogues, people are behaving nicer in synagogue. You walk in, you take your seat, you sit there throughout the service, you pick up and leave. In other religions, not that I ever attended a service, but from what I hear, people behave. There's a certain etiquette, there's protocol. You stand, you sit, you don't just chat during a service. Why is it that way? And it's possible because when Jews are in synagogue, they're not just in a synagogue, they're in their own home. And when you're in your own home, you just behave the way you are. You're not being somebody else when you're there. At home is where we act most like who we are. We don't make believe anymore. When we're out of our house, that's when we put up a front and we're in our best behavior. At synagogue, we, like in our homes, we behave that way. And again, I'm not condoning or supporting chattery during services, okay? You're not gonna be able to walk out of here saying the rabbi says we can chat during services. But that's just the reality, that's just the fact. And that may be an indication of what the essence of the relationship is. So let's wrap up this idea here. Let's stick to the screens. A synchronized Jew expresses his or her Jewishness through behavior and belief. So we said, on one hand, we did say that every single Jew, you cannot lose your Jewish identity even if you don't believe in God. At the same time, obviously, believing in God is a critical component to Judaism. A synchronized Jew expresses his or her Jewishness through behavior and belief. A synchronized Jew is the term they're using here for someone who doesn't just believe in God deep down in their essence, but actually expresses that belief in their daily life and behaves and lives according to Judaism and the Jewish values. Failure to do so doesn't undo one's Jewish status. Deep inside, the soul remains loyal to God. So, you know what, I'm not gonna dwell on this idea. There's a text on this, and you are free to read it after the class or on your own time. Beyond the conscious thoughts, the soul continues to believe. So, as we said, you can't, there's two different wavelengths. There's the mind, and then there's the soul. It's possible for somebody's mind not to be in tune with their Jewishness. In other words, consciously, in their mind, they may not believe in God today. They may have their questions and their doubts, which kind of takes us into the next question. Nonetheless, the soul is not impacted by any of that. The essence remains intact. So, do I have to believe in God to be Jewish?
No.
The answer is no, you don't have to. However, there's always a however at the end of our questions. Jewish identity is dependent on the soul, not one's belief. Beyond the conscious, all Jews have complete faith. I just want to conclude with this thought, that there were times in our history, like the story I just shared about Elie Wiesel, where people were confronted by this dilemma of or this choice of rejecting their Jewish faith at the cost of their life. And as we know, many, many Jews would do so, even Jews who didn't live Jewishly throughout their life, again, like Wiesel testified. And this proves the fact that even someone who doesn't profess to be a believer in God, even they have the essence which remains intact. It's just that it doesn't emerge. It could not emerge even once throughout one's whole life. Or it can emerge when a moment of truth comes their way and they're confronted by something like that. So it used to be that Jews sacrificed their life in order to maintain their Jewish identity and their faith. Nowadays, thank God, we more or less don't have to. Unfortunately, there's still instances here and there. Two people lost their life in Jerusalem a few days ago just because they're Jewish. In fact, this week we commemorated the Yahrzeit of the 5 or 6 Jews who lost their life in Mumbai, India, including the Chabad rabbi and Rebbetzin Gabi and Rifki Holtzberg in their Chabad house in Mumbai. Their Yahrzeit was 4 days ago. I believe it was... how many years? Like 13 years, roughly? Was it 2008. So it's about 15 years. So it still happens, unfortunately. But the vast majority of us are not confronted, thank God, by scenarios where we are threatened by our life because of our Jewishness. Today, our challenge is different. Our challenge is not to die for our Judaism, but to actually live for our Judaism. And that's another whole challenge. And it's possible that it's even more difficult. Because someone who gives up their life for their Judaism, it's a radical moment beyond description, but it's one moment of sacrifice. When someone has to live for their Judaism, it's not one moment of sacrifice, but it's a sacrifice throughout their entire life, every day of their life. And that is our challenge. Thank God we don't have the other one, but we need to embrace our challenge, and that is to allow our essential faith, which is at the core of our being, to emerge and to inspire our daily life in actuality. This concludes question number one for tonight. Any quick questions or comments on this? All good? All right. We will advance forward. Question number two, is it kosher to have doubts about God? Raise your hand if you think yes. Raise your hand if you say that doubts are not kosher. Okay. So yes. There are many Jews who would consider themselves believers in God. If you ask them, do you believe in God, they'll say yes. However, whether they are willing to admit it or not, they do experience doubts within their belief with their faith in God. So number one, if someone has doubts in their faith, do they still have faith? Do they really believe if doubts pop into their head? That's number one. And number two, The question is, maybe if somebody really had faith in God, they wouldn't have any doubts. Maybe if they do, they don't really have faith. If someone has doubts, are they considered a bad Jew? I get that a lot from people. Rabbi, I'm a bad Jew. Then they could do whatever they want, as we'll talk about soon. So, the question is, how can a faithful believer harbor doubts? And that's because the essence of our soul, and this kind of continues from our last question, or last answer to the previous question, the reason why the soul has this faith that's indestructible, what does it mean? Like, how do you explain it? So the soul is a piece of God. It's an actual piece of God. So the soul basically sees God. The soul doesn't believe in God because it was convinced that there is a God. That's how the mind buys into faith, by explaining this, the idea. The soul believes in God because the soul sees God. If you see an event, if you witness something, and someone comes and tries to tell you and ask you questions and basically try to convince you that it's not the way you saw it, what are you going to say?
There's no way, right?
Say whatever you want. I saw what happened. You're not going to convince me otherwise. Why? Because you saw it. This is why the soul can't be shaken out of its faith, because it sees God. When you see something, then you don't need anything else. So once the soul does see God, then how could you have doubts? That's really the question. So where do doubts come from? So now we're going to define and explain the idea of how someone who believes in God even has doubts. Okay. Similar to what we explained and touched upon maybe last week, the way God wanted things to work in this world is that things aren't just all good. God didn't want programmed beings who are good and only do good always. God created a world specifically where evil exists, where darkness exists, and it's all around us. And in order to do something good, we have to reject evil. And we discussed this last week, that the fact that there is evil in the world justifies the good. When we choose good, it's actually valuable, because when we are making a good choice, we are rejecting evil. And that's why there's value to choosing good. Similarly, when it comes to faith in God, we just established that we have our faith and it's unshakable. It's deep down, it's in our essence, and it's always there. So where are doubts coming from? So here's the good news. When somebody has doubts and questions their faith in God, we don't need to be moved by them, because the questions are not coming from us. The questions are coming from the outside. It's not me who has doubts when I'm experiencing doubts, and who doesn't at some point in their life for whatever reason. But the good news is that even when we have doubts, it's not us who's doubting it. It's an external outside voice. Let me define this a little bit more first. First of all, are doubts okay? So the answer is that they're perfectly okay, because we're human beings and it's normal to doubt. There's a story about someone who once came to the Rebbe known as the Tzemach Tzedek. He was the third Rebbe in the Chabad dynasty. And this person approached him and said, Rebbe, I'm experiencing doubts in my faith in God. So the Rebbe said, oh, okay. And how's your health? How's your family? Oh, everyone's okay. I'm doing okay. But I have doubts in my faith. Oh, okay. Okay, what else? How's it going in your community? And he answered the question, but again came back and said, I mean, you're not hearing me. I'm having doubts about my faith in God. So the Rebbe said, okay, like so what? He said, what do you mean? I'm a Jew. He said, oh, if that's the case, then you're good to go. In other words, the fact that he was disturbed that he's having doubts in his faith, why was he bothered by it? because I'm a Jew. The fact that he's bothered by it is the greatest indication that his faith is intact. And once his faith is intact, because it bothered him that he had the doubts, there was nothing to worry about. That's actually a healthy individual. That's a healthy human being. You can have doubts, but the fact that if you were indifferent and it didn't matter, and you just moved on in life, okay, maybe that would be a reason for concern. But this individual who came to find advice of how to deal with his doubts, because I'm a Jew, how can I have doubts? That's a healthy person. That's a healthy spiritual immune system. And therefore, that's the first thing we need to know, that it's absolutely normal. And if we are experiencing doubts and they bother us, then most certainly it's 1,000% normal and it's okay. Because it's actually just an indication that we actually do have faith, and that's why it bothers us. Now the question is how we should deal with them. So now that we know it's totally normal, it's totally okay, because it's totally okay to have them. God wishes that a Jew be tempted with alternatives, and despite the allurement he or she chooses, to remain steadfast in their faith. So God created the reality to be this way because he wants us to have voices that question our faith. And by us rejecting those voices, that is adding a lot of value to our faith. So God actually orchestrates things that we should experience doubt in our faith. And then when we say no to those doubts, and when we reject them, so it actually is making our faith much more reinforced. And this is exactly how God set things up. This is how God wants it. Let's read a fascinating text from the Zohar. Erica, would you like to read? Or Manny, whichever one you want. Text number 6 on page 118. This is straight out of the Zohar, which is the original work of Kabbalah.
God wished that people constantly serve him and follow the true path to merit much good. If this is indeed God's will, how could an evil servant come and incite against the will of his master, turn people to the evil path, thrust them from the good path, and cause them not to do the will of their master? Certainly he is doing the will of his master. This is analogous to a king who had only one son whom he cherished. He lovingly commanded him not to come near a disreputable woman, because anyone who approached her would not be worthy to enter the king's palace. The son promised that he would lovingly heed his father's command. Outside the king's palace was a prostitute who was very beautiful to behold. After a few days, the king said, "I want to see my son's feelings towards me." He called the prostitute and told her, "Seduce my son to test his feelings towards me." What did the prostitute do? She pursued the king's son and started to grab him, kiss him, and seduce him in various ways. Now, if the son were decent and heeded his father's commands, he would scold her, ignore her, and thrust her away. Then the father rejoices with his son, brings him into the inner sanctum of his palace, and gives him presents, gifts, and great honor.
Thank you. So this analogy is shedding a lot of very profound light on our struggles in life. And it really tells us how we should respond and react when we experience a negative voice, whether it's voices of doubt or temptation, etc. This is what we need to realize. How are we supposed to react? Do we start debating and answering and arguing back to these doubts, to these voices? Absolutely not. Why not? Why does it not make sense to argue back?
It gives them power.
It gives them power, number one. But more importantly, you're arguing with someone who also knows the truth. Just like this prostitute, as we just read from the Zohar, who was hired by the king to seduce the prince. For what purpose? Just to be able to bring out the resolve of the prince by rejecting her. So when the king hired the prostitute, did the prostitute know what her job is? The prostitute knows that her job is to be rejected. So she knows that she's not representing the truth. She knows that her whole purpose is so that he should turn her down. So, in other words, she's in on the game. She knows exactly why she was hired. She has to do a good job seducing the prince, but she ultimately knows what she's there for. Similarly, when we hear voices of doubt, we need to know, number one, that it's not us, it's coming from the outside. Who are these voices representing? God actually set things up that we should have this evil inclination that speaks these whatever, feeds us these ideas of doubt or whatever temptation it is. But the whole purpose of these voices being there is for us to reject it, not to argue with it, because by arguing, you're totally missing the point, because you're talking to someone who's in on the game. The voice of doubt that we're hearing knows exactly what its purpose is. It knows the truth. It's just taking on, it's coming in disguise with the purpose of trying to turn you away from the truth. But it knows the truth. It's almost like when you, I don't know about you, but I get a lot of spam calls to my cell phone.
Right.
And sales calls. When you pick up a call and you, if you didn't know or whatever, and you say hello, and they start selling you something, what are you going to do? You're going to start engaging them in conversation? Raise your hand if you engage those calls in conversation. Nobody raised their hand. Why is that? Because how do you deal with an issue like that? You either hang up the phone or you don't want to talk to, because you're not going to win. You don't bother. Similarly, when you hear these voices, the way to react to them is just to push them away. Not to debate, not to try to answer, because again, you're missing the point. They know the truth. You don't have to convince them of the truth. They know why they were planted. They're just doing their job. And their real purpose is that we should reject them, and that's how they actually fulfill the reason for their existence altogether. So let's just wrap this up here. Once we see the truth, we should be immune to doubt. You would think that that's the case. But God gave the evil inclination permission to do the seemingly impossible, to raise false doubts in the face of faith. So we need to know that who am I? I am a Jew with a soul who believes in the Creator. And I also have doubts. The doubts are coming from the outside. That's what we need to realize. We need to know that regardless, even if we're hearing those voices, it doesn't call into question who we are. We have a soul and we have faith. The fact that we have those doubts don't mean much. God rigged this game. Outside voices will come along and try to test my resolve. But we need to know that these voices are just planted. They were put there to test us. And by rejecting them is exactly how we fulfill the purpose of why we even had those doubts in the first place. So it's God's confidence in your ability to overcome them. Can you imagine that? When we hear voices of doubt in our head, it's actually because God believes in us and knows that we have what it takes to reject those voices. So actually, when God sends somebody a test of faith, it's because God knows that that person, God's confident that that person is very strong in their faith. And they'll have what it takes to be able to overcome it. If God sees your faith as being shaky and weak, he's not going to send you doubts. He's not going to test your faith, because you may not actually overcome it. And the whole purpose of the doubts is so that you should overcome it. So in truth, it's just God showing his confidence in us when he does send us these voices. They're a testament to your superior power, so counter them from a place of empowerment. The evil inclination believes in God and raises these doubts because God wants to test us. As we said, the more a person engages, the more they stand to lose. So is it kosher to have doubts about God? We all know the answer. It's totally kosher. It may even be glatt kosher. Yes, it is part of God's plan to test us. So we swat them away and we carry on. Any questions on this?
I have one.
Yes, please, Nick.
So, does this help refine your character, this process?
Absolutely. That's the purpose of tests. As we know, Abraham was tested by God, not once, not twice, not three times, but 10 times. And he came through with flying colors. And that's why he became who he became. And every one of us, God has big plans for each one of us. And when we are able to overcome those tests, yes, it fortifies our faith and strengthens us and reinforces who we are. All good? All right, let's move on to the next. It's an exciting format for a course. Go from one question to the next. We keep things exciting instead of just one topic a whole night. Okay, so we talked, I mentioned before, third question for tonight is, why must I fear God? What is up with the fear? What is up with the fear? And we know in text 8a, Larry, could you please read that for us on page 121 from Maimonides?
It is a mitzvah to love and fear this glorious and awesome God, as the verses state, and thou shalt love your God and fear your God.
Thank you. So there's different verses within the Torah itself that says that we should fear God. So why is it necessary to fear God? Because fear, as we know, is not a very wonderful emotion. Fear actually destroys relationships. So why does God command us to fear Him? If there's fear, if one spouse fears another, do you think that relationship will last? Not really. Bless you. Bless you again. So let's take a look here. So what does fear actually mean? A basic and intense emotion aroused by the detection of an imminent threat coming our direction. That is what generates fear. So is there any way for that to even be remotely okay? Let's see what Maimonides says, though, about telling us how we're supposed to fear God. An emotion that stems from an appreciation of how great God is and how small we are in comparison. So what does fear of God mean? It means that we recognize God's greatness, and the result of that is we realize how small we are. So could the two fears mean the same thing? Maimonides is telling us that fear seems to be a very good emotion, which comes from an appreciation of how great God is. But the fear that we know of in a relationship of human beings is a very toxic emotion. If that's the case, then what exactly is Maimonides saying? So it must be that the fear in the Torah, where it says that we should fear God, and where Maimonides elaborates that fear is a very healthy emotion and an important component in our relationship with God, it has to mean something else. It can't mean the fear that we run away from. It just can't. So rather, a much better word to replace fear would be awe. Awe of God is a healthy emotion. It's a healthy aspect or component to the relationship with God. Why is that? Why is awe more accurate than fear is? What is awe? Awe is a combination of admiration, of humility, and of respect. You admire something or someone so much that it humbles you. That's the definition of awe. So when we talk about fear of God, the much more accurate word is awe of God. And in that context, it makes sense, because when you're confronted by the awesomeness of God, it actually should lead us to become more humble and to feel a great measure of respect and admiration for God. Yes, Lou.
We're kind of stuck with the connotation of the word fear in translation of Yireh. And I've always rejected the fear to be afraid of God in favor of awe and respect, magnanimous awe. So why are most of the translations using the word fear instead of awe or some other word that might be more appropriate?
It's a good question. It's not the perfect translation. And by the way, being afraid, if someone says they're afraid of God, what would you think, how would you define that? Why would somebody be afraid of God? Fear meaning fear, actual fear. Maybe,
you're
yes?
Afraid to be hurt.
Are
hurt because of what? Maybe doing something wrong and then being punished?
Whatever. Yeah, afraid.
Linda?
Afraid.
Yeah. Something like that, right?
Or Karen. Maybe the fear of missing out. Of missing out of knowing God.
But that would be more in the awe realm.
Yeah, but so study out fear. I mean, doesn't he says that throughout the whole scripture, right? I mean,
So that we have to get to the bottom of that. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. So fear, when it's like fear of punishment or God, reacting to us going wrong, if someone's afraid of punishment, they're not afraid of God. You're afraid of punishment. And in essence, that's really selfish because you're just afraid that something's going to happen to you. So I'm not in awe of God. I'm just afraid of how this is going to impact me. So that's a very elementary level. If someone is afraid to sin because of punishment, then they're not really in a relationship with God. They're in a relationship with themselves. They're just trying to spear punishment. So that's very elementary. That's like, it's more like a child's level relationship to God. But when we mature, we shouldn't be thinking about ourselves. And we'll get to that a little bit more soon. So, yes.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think maybe the fear is actually fearing the unknown, not necessarily fearing God, because maybe we don't have relationship, and that's what we're fearful of, not actually.
Okay, that's a great observation. Let me ask you a question. Could you identify a certain time in your life when you felt awestruck? Can anybody share something brief, please?
Yeah.
Could have been by somebody or something.
First time I dove on a submarine, we went underwater. I was a bit awestruck because I realized that my life was in the hands of everyone else on board. And I was the new guy, so I just kind of had to sit there and deal with it. It was a bit shocking.
Okay, but that was maybe a little bit more fear than awe. Would you say that?
Probably.
Okay. Yes, Irene?
I was going to say the first time I ever went scuba diving, I was just in awe of a world I had never seen before.
Okay. Anybody else? So believe it or not, this summer I spent 2 or 3 days in Colorado for the first time in my life. I lived in Texas for 13 years already. But obviously we only did what we did in 2-3 days, but there were various different sites that we visited, and I was awestruck at the wonders of God and God's creation for the first time. I don't know if I'm not sure I ever experienced that in Brooklyn, New York. Over there, maybe it's more fear, not necessarily awe. But I was awestruck, and I'm sure all of you could relate to some instance in your life where you had such a reaction. Now, when we talk about awe in an instance like that, it's not fear, you're not afraid, it's awe, meaning you're in the presence of greatness, and that makes you feel humble. It instills a sense of humility. I want to share a story that was shared by a rabbi. He's the editor of Chabad.org. I believe he still is. His name is Rabbi Tzvi Freeman. You may have read articles by him because he's written a lot on the website. Anyway, he says he lived in Toronto. I don't know if he still lives there, but regardless, he once met someone by the name of Marvin. Marvin Elkind. And this Marvin told Rabbi Freeman the following thing. He said that in his life, he never knew fear except for once in his lifetime. And Marvin didn't exactly live a life that was like protected from any threats. He was actually someone who was a security, he was a high-level security guard. He dealt with... He helped the Toronto Police Department arrest some of the worst criminals. He did a lot of things in his life where he could have been afraid. or where he could have experienced fear, but none of those instances brought him to any fear. He says only one time. And the rabbi said, tell me what that one instance was. He said, when I was living in Toronto and I was asked to drive Prime Minister of Israel, Golda Meir, from somewhere to a meeting. And she was in my car, sitting in the back seat. That was the only time this guy felt fear, or more accurately, awe in his life. And again, we're not talking about someone who served as a rabbi in a synagogue. We're talking about someone who was out there and had many, many opportunities to feel a sense of fear, but he never did. And this is exactly the point. And this is exactly the point, because when we are in the presence of, again, it could be a person, it could be a thing, it could be a sight, but when we're in the presence of greatness, that's the only time we really feel awe. Now, in a relationship, why is it necessary to have fear in a relationship? Why not just love? Anybody?
How do you mean fear? Fear of loss.
Fear or awe. Why is that a necessary emotion in a relationship? Why not just if there's love?
It inspires your behavior.
Yeah. Well, if you love somebody, you would think that would be enough to behave in the correct way and the way the relationship calls for.
Because it's not about you. You fear what would happen if you lose it.
Yes, but how about within the relationship? Why is it necessary to have it within the relationship?
Respect.
Respect, yes. I'm hearing it.
It's a compliment of yourself, I think.
So what is love? When someone says, what is love in a relationship? First of all, how is love even expressed? Somebody says, I love you to someone else. What's the first word they're saying?
I.
Is I. They're... It's very self-focused. When someone loves someone else, chances are it's because that person is bringing them whatever they're looking for in a relationship, they're finding or receiving from that person. It's being provided to them, so they love that person because of what it's doing for them. But if that's all there is in a relationship, then that alone is not enough to fuel a long-term relationship, because then it's just going to be about you. And if it's about me, then at some point in the relationship, it's not going to work anymore. Think about when somebody, you walk into a restaurant and you see somebody eating a delicious chicken dish, and they say, I love chicken. Is that true? No. Because if they loved the chicken, they would have left it alone. They love themselves. I love me. And I love chicken. I love the taste of chicken. Therefore, that's exactly, you don't love the chicken. So love could be all about the self. It's about what I'm looking for. That's why in a relationship, it's critical that there's also a healthy dose of awe, which is respect, which is admiration, humility, all these words that I was hearing, because you also have to respect the other person's space in a relationship. There has to be love, which represents closeness, and there has to be awe, which instills a sense of humility in the relationship. And we need that in order to respect each other's space and give each other the necessary space within the relationship. So love and awe are both very necessary. Let's get up to date here. So we understand that fear of God really means awe that we established, but can't we just stick to love? So love is selfish. Because I want to connect to him. I want to make him happy. It's all about the I. It's self-focused. But awe is humbling. An awareness of how great he, she, or it is, whatever your awe is of, when there is that emotion, then it actually makes you aware of how great the other is. And personal desires don't matter. So if it's only about love, then I may get caught up in the self at some point, or too caught up in the self. But if there's also respect, awe, which leads to respect, admiration, and humility, then I'll think less of myself and more about the person I am in a relationship with. Love alone won't fuel a relationship. When there's also awe, it keeps a relationship afloat. So, by the way, if you read a New York Times article about what we call the ultra-Orthodox Jews in New York or in Jerusalem, how are they usually referred to? It with a Hebrew term. Anyone know? Charedim. Anyone know what the word Charedi means?
It's separate, doesn't it?
The literal meaning of Chared means like to tremble. It basically means awe. You could also say fear, but it's not really fear. Now we know it means awe. Why is that the case? Because for whatever reason, this segment of Jews are referred to as being in awe of God. What does that mean? And why is this component, is this aspect so critical when it comes to the life of a Jew? That's because when someone realizes and acknowledges that they're in God's presence, wherever they are, and we kind of spoke about this in the first lesson about where God is, but that's not the point today. The point is that someone who's aware of their relationship with God and is in love with God and is in awe of God, in other words, God is everywhere. Just like that driver who had the prime minister in his car, and that's the only time in his life he felt awestruck. So a Jew who realizes that God is always present lives a different life, because you're in the presence of God always. God is in your car. God is in your home. God is in my office. And when you have that feeling, then everything is different. The good days are different. You're more inspired because you realize that everything you're doing, God is, so to speak, present there with you. What's the first thing we say when we wake up in the morning? We don't first go about our business and then we think about God. God is not a chore. The first, we open up our eyes immediately, we're acknowledging God's presence and God restoring our soul to us. All that is because we're in awe and we realize that just our existence, I'm still in my bed, I just opened my eyes. But we're already acknowledging the fact that we are in God's presence, and that defines everything about us. If it defines the first minute of your day, there's a very good chance it will define the rest of your day. And it will inspire decisions that you're going to make throughout the day. And finally, on this topic, one of the greatest sages, Rabbi Yochanan, he was on his deathbed. He was about to pass away. And his students, and this is recorded in the Talmud, his students were there at his bedside, and they said to him, give us what are your parting words? Give us a parting message. And he said, I wish you that your awe of God Almighty should be to the same degree of your awe of a human king of flesh and blood. That means, I'm going to use the word fear, but we now know what it means, so don't get confused. Your fear of God should be to the same degree as you fear a human king of flesh and blood. They were like, these are your parting words? That we should respect God the way we do a king of flesh and blood? Like really? And he said, if only, those were his last words. If only. So they thought, they were a little underwhelmed by his last words. What do you mean? God is much greater than a human king. And that's how I have to fear God like I do a human king. He said, if only. Why is that? Because if we are able to relate to God and God's presence the way we would to someone, coming back to that driver when the prime minister was in his car, it was real. That was the only time he was awestruck. If we're able, if we... And by the way, these things don't happen just by itself. This takes a lot of thought, takes a lot of meditation. We had a whole course on Jewish meditation last year. Because you have to think about these ideas. They don't just happen. But if you meditate on them, and you think about them, and you realize what you think about and meditate on God's awesomeness and God's greatness, and how you fit into the picture, and how the humility that you experience as a result, then it's a whole different world. And this is exactly what the rabbi meant. That yes, that God and your relationship with God should be so real as a human being is to you. That's what he meant. Not that you should have a small measure of awe of God, like of a human. On the contrary, it should be so real to you, just like a human is real. That's how real God should be to you. And it should actually inspire the way you behave, as if, like when you're in the presence of a human being who you're in awe of. So let's wrap this one up. Why must I fear God? Fear of God is a deep sense of awe, and it takes us out of our naturally selfish ways, bringing us closer to God. Looks like there's a question or comment here. No? All good? Okay. Let's go to our final topic for tonight, and that is, I'm okay with believing in God, but I'm not religious. Can we still have a relationship? So I'm okay with just believing in God, but being religious is a whole different story. So if I'm ready to believe in God, and I do, but I'm not exactly changing my lifestyle, I'm not going to become religious, could we still have a relationship with God? A woman came to the post office around this time of year, in the next week or two, and said, can I get 50 Hanukkah stamps, please? And the clerk said, what denomination? She said, well, 20 conservative, 20 reform, and 10 orthodox. I realize I didn't say any jokes yet tonight.
That's actually very good.
So, to get straight to the point here with this question. Is it okay? Can I still be in a relationship with God if I'm not religious? So the answer in one line is that your relationship with God has nothing to do with religion. Could I repeat that? Your relationship with God has nothing to do with religion. Okay? If you look at me, and someone asks you, is that rabbi religious? What are you going to say? You're going to say yes, right? Because he wears a kippah, and he has a beard, and he has tzitzit hanging from the sides, and he dresses a certain way. And he, you know, more or less, if anyone is, it's going to be him, right? But what are you doing to me, basically? You're putting me in a box. Because you see me behaving a certain way, and in your mind, and this is how we like to be in general. We like to box everything up. We see somebody, we see something, we need to fit it into a certain file in our mind. So we right away need to size them up and see where they fit into everything I know so far. Oh, they're that? Okay. I know what that is already. And it also keeps us closed-minded because we're not really open to explore new things because we're just immediately labeling things and people that we encounter. So, you know, people try to avoid being labeled with things. You know, we do certain things, but don't, okay? Like, if somebody asks me if I'm a fundraiser, what am I going to say? I raise funds, but I'm not a fundraiser. Meaning, I may do some of that, but that's not who I am or what I am. And the same is with anyone. If you have a hobby and someone asks you, well, is that who you are? You can say, no, it's just something I do in my free time. It's not who I am, right? So when it comes to being religious or not religious, for some reason, we're stuck in these labels. Your relationship with God has nothing to do with religion. Religion is commonly viewed as a status and identity. People label other people as that one is religious or that one's not religious, or people view themselves either as religious or I'm not religious. Now, what's the problem with this approach? So, I'm sure you've heard at some point since we met that Chabad doesn't believe in labels. Now, some people think that's a PR tactic. You know, it makes everyone feel comfortable. The truth is, it's not a PR tactic at all. It's an absolute truth. The Chabad really doesn't believe in labels. Why is that? Because this is what labels could potentially do to Jews who use them. Let's take a look. So at both ends, identifying oneself religiously, meaning using religion as an identity, is dangerous. Identifying as non-religious. What's the problem if somebody would identify themselves as not religious? What's the downside?
Well, they don't really give themselves away to express their belief in a sense. They push themselves outside the door.
I'll illustrate that with a story. So I visit somebody in the hospital once, a family, and the grandfather was the patient in the hospital. And his son was present, and his grandson was also present. So three generations were in the hospital. Now, like I always would do, of course, depending on the situation and the person and the status or whatever, of course, we'll say a prayer together. But in a scenario like that, when it is possible, I'll offer the patient, first and foremost, to wrap tefillin, to do a mitzvah. Of course, opening the channels between a patient and God Almighty makes them more conducive to additional blessings. So I wrap tefillin with the grandfather. But then, next in line was the grandson. And he was about 15. He had his bar mitzvah already, but still never wrapped tefillin, even at his bar mitzvah. So we wrapped tefillin with him. And then I asked his father, so the son to the patient, father to that boy, would you like to do it? And he said, no, it's okay, I'm Reform. So what's the problem with that answer? So basically he was saying, I'm not religious. He labeled himself as not religious. But look what it did. It just deprived him of the opportunity to do a mitzvah and perform a good deed, a commandment of God Almighty, an opportunity to say a blessing and a prayer for his father. He was robbed because of how he defines himself as not religious or Reform, whatever the particular language is. So the danger of calling oneself not religious is clear. Because then, if I'm not, then why should I bother ever doing something Jewish? Or why should I ever do a mitzvah if it has no value to me because I'm not religious? And if that means religion and I'm not religious, then I have nothing with it. Okay, so that's clear. That's an issue with someone who says they're not religious. What about somebody who calls themselves religious? What's the problem with that? I'm a religious Jew. What's the downside? That's the upside. What's the downside of calling yourself religious?
It puts other people off, so you can't connect to them.
That's an obnoxious religious person.
You need a self-esteem, you might not be able to live up to, although you should be able to live up to. That's what you do. You also have a downside. You might give the religion a bad reputation. If you do bad stuff and you call yourself religious, it's not good.
So, okay, so someone is religious.
That's a relative term. I mean, one person's religious is another person's not religious. So
That's true. That's very true. So if somebody is calling themselves religious, so yes, if they now do something wrong and they're visibly Jewish and somebody sees, then they're also desecrating God's name. But even for themselves, not for other people, what would the downside be of someone defining themselves as religious? So basically, if someone is religious, then if, let's say, they fall short on one occasion, let's say one Shabbat they couldn't really observe it, or one instance they just didn't have a kosher meal, what's that person going to tell himself? Well, I'm religious anyway. I'm a religious Jew. So one time doing something that's unreligious is not going to change my status here and there. If I just share a little bit of gossip, am I now not a religious Jew? I'm still religious. Look how I dress. Look at the hat I'm wearing. Look at the synagogue I attend. Look at my sideburns, my payas, my black coat. I can do whatever I want because I'm religious. And I'm still going to be even after I do that. So here are the dangers in using these definitions of religious or non-religious. Like we said before, if someone defines themselves as not religious, so if I'm not all in, then what's the point of doing anything? If there's no point in doing, if I'm anyway not going to be religious, why should I light my Shabbat candles one Friday if I'm still not going to be religious after that? This is the problem with calling oneself not religious. Because if I'm not all in, then why bother with anything? I'm sure you've been stopped by Chabad boys on Fifth Avenue somewhere in New York or the Fifth Avenue anywhere, right? What do they do? Actually, a friend was just in New York a few weeks ago, walking on Lexington Avenue, and he was stopped by two Chabad boys and offered to wrap tefillin. So, first of all, he was able to say, I actually did it already this morning, which is the best answer they can get. But after chatting with them for another couple minutes, it turned out that one of those two boys was Esty's younger brother. And now there's probably 1,000 boys like this spread out across New York City. But our friend from here encountered him. That goes back to our conversation about God sending us messages. But I digress. So if somebody is approached with an opportunity to do a mitzvah, so if they're not religious, then there's no reason why they should agree to do it on the street, because they're still not going to be afterwards. And similarly, if somebody calls themselves religious, identifying as religious, if I look the part, there can't be much wrong with my little misdoings. Even if I go wrong here and there, well, I'm still a religious Jew. So there's the problem or the danger with going with either one of these two approaches. In other words, religious identity could actually enable sin. Could you imagine that? So, let's read this text, number 11. Where are we, Lynn? Text 11, please, on 126. This is from Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, from the Tanya.
When you fulfill God's will, your godly soul, your bodily consciousness, and all their expressions are united in perfect unity with God. This union endures forever because God and His will transcend time.
Thank you. These lines are very powerful because they define a lot of Chabad philosophy. The Chabad approach of seeing value in every individual good deed, even if somebody may never wrap tefillin again or light Shabbat candles again. Let's say they'll never do it again. Is there value in doing it right now, one time in their life? Absolutely. And these lines define that, because when you do a mitzvah, you're actually creating something eternal. You're not just doing something, just some motion. You're not even just doing something that if I do it again, then it gives value to this time. No. If I do a mitzvah one time, I am establishing and creating a spiritual energy that is going to be eternal. It cannot be undone. And that's why there's value to doing a mitzvah even once without knowing if I'm ever going to repeat it again. Because if there's no value to doing it once, then why is there value to doing it 1,000 times? If there's no value to wrapping tefillin once, then if I do 1,000 times zero, I still have zero. So there has to be infinite value even to doing it one time. And that's why doing it daily is also valuable, or however often you're going to do it. So, we said that being religious has nothing to do with our relationship with God. So what does define our relationship with God? How should we view it? And this will be our closing thought for the day, for the evening. Judaism is not about attaining a religious state. Okay, remember that. Important, powerful information. Judaism is not about our religious status. It's not about becoming religious. It's not about not being religious or avoiding being religious. It's about a relationship with God. Judaism is about serving and connecting with God, which is accomplished through mitzvot. Every time we do a mitzvah of any kind, it's like picking up the phone and calling your mother. As we said before, our relationship with God in Judaism, it's like a family relationship. It's like a relationship with a parent. How often do you pick up a phone and call your parent? Some people very often, some people twice a day, some people twice a year. But does that mean if they don't, that they shouldn't? Let's say somebody hasn't called their mother in 5 years. That means they shouldn't because there's no value in it anymore because they're just not a good son, so don't bother. That's foolish. Of course you should. Obviously, there's value to doing it one time. If you can do it many more times, there's a lot more value to it. But that is the essence of Judaism. It is a relationship with God. Every mitzvah is an opportunity to connect with God. It's another link in that relationship. It's another bond. A mitzvah, a different name for a mitzvah, call it a connector. An opportunity to connect with God Almighty. Religious and irreligious Jews mean absolutely nothing. Rather, Jews who connect often or Jews who do less frequently. Maybe there's a difference. Someone who does more mitzvahs, okay, they call their mother more often. They create opportunities to connect with God more frequently than someone who does so less. But to define this one as religious and this one as not religious, there's absolutely no value to those terms, to those definitions, and they only do harm. Regardless of consistency, it is always worthwhile to enhance our relationship with God. One mitzvah may seem insignificant, yet, if we evaluate the world as equally balanced, this one mitzvah has tremendous value. As Maimonides says, very well-known words, that we have to view the world as always being perfectly in balance, and our one good deed can tip the scale and change the world for good. So our closing thought for today is that Judaism has nothing to do with religion. What it does have to do with is a relationship with God, and mitzvahs are opportunities to strengthen that relationship. The more you do them, the stronger the bond between you and God Almighty. So I encourage you to grab every opportunity to do so, because the more we do so, the more connected. Yes, Linda?
Who defines what a mitzvah is?
The Torah.
It's a mitzvah to call your mother?
Yes, the fifth commandment.
Okay.
Honor your father and mother.
Call your mother.
We're going to conclude here with wrapping it up here with the closing. So let's just actually wrap it up. I'm okay with believing in God, but I'm not religious. Can we still have a relationship? Forget about religion and start building your relationship with God through a mitzvah. Thank you for joining.
His expectations.
I'm going to let it go.
1. Judaism is not only a culture, ethnicity, race, or religion. It is the essence of a Jew by dint of their having a Jewish soul. 2. Because of their Jewish soul, a Jew, A, is inherently Jewish, regardless of whether they believe in God.